Good evening. Welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
Later on Building Bridges, behind the scenes of the Sago mine collapse hearings. But first, Dr. Vicente Navarro, professor of health and public policy, sociology and policy studies at the Johns Hopkins University, and editor-in-chief of the International Journal of Health Services, explores the critical problem of why 44 million American residents have no health coverage and what we can do about it.
Let's begin by analyzing how class power actually explains the U.S. health system.
Well, that is very easy. If we go back to the Taft-Hartley Act, the most class-based piece of legislation that the United States has had since World War II, the Taft-Hartley Act forbids, for example, sympathy strike. Coal miners, for example, cannot strike in support of steel workers. That is the only developed capitalist country that is the case. If you go to France or Spain, you can find a general strike. A general strike is forbidden in the United States by law. So that is what Taft-Hartley Act. It forbids the American working class to work as a class. In that same legislation, there's a component that says that the health benefit had to be negotiated in the collective bargaining agreement. So it was not through the state, as most of European countries or Canada, but had to do on the private sector through negotiations between workers on the one side and employers on the other. Now, the collective bargaining agreement in the United States is highly decentralized, as you might know. Well, it means that when a worker loses a job, does lose not only his or her salary, but also the health benefit coverage for the family, which has an enormous impact in terms of disciplined labor, and that was the intention of. So the Taft-Hartley Act basically established that the health benefits are going to be provided through the employer, and the employer uses that in order to control labor. No other country has ever done that. You see then that the enormous unevenness in the health benefit coverage among the working class in the United States is based on that. Wherever you might have a strong union, then you might have a fairly good coverage, although even the best coverage in the United States does not compare with the average coverage in any country in Europe. For example, the elderly who have a federal government are basically very limited coverage, not to speak about the average worker whose coverage is very limited. Even the steel workers who have the best benefit coverage have a limited coverage, particularly when you compare with any country in Europe. So in that sense, you find an enormous variety. So if you don't have a union or weak union, then you don't have coverage, or the coverage is very, very limited. So that is divide and conquer. That designs a system whereby each group of labor has to take care of itself, and that how much he gets depends on its strength in the collective bargaining agreement, which is highly decentralized, and therefore you have good coverage in some areas, very poor coverage in another. That is called class, you see, and that is what is usually avoided in most of the analysis of what is wrong with the healthcare of the United States. So that means that what we have had since the Taft-Hartley Act is an alliance between the insurance on the one side and the employers on the other, so that is the block that governs the healthcare sector of the United States. The insurance have an enormous power because the employer's employees pay to the private insurance, and then the insurance contract with the private providers. In that transaction, there is a huge administrative cost because the providers, moreover, are paid on a diagnostic basis, which means a huge administrative cost. But what the center of power is the alliance between the insurance and the employers, an alliance that has been questioned because it is increasingly burdensome for the employers to have to absorb these benefit costs. Still, what's interesting is that even now, when the cost of covering health insurance for the employees is quite high, there's still a reluctance from the employers to, let's say, choose the Canadian route, that employers and employees pay to the public sector, or like in Europe, that is paid with taxes. How is it that General Motors or Ford, that spent a lot of money in covering their employees, are still reluctant to go in the European route because they control labor? Put yourself in the situation of a worker that when you lose a job, you lose the health benefit coverage for you and your family, you think twice before raising trouble. So that is why the employers, even now, are reluctant to change that.
There are a number of different healthcare systems. Most people who want reform are focusing on the single payer or Medicare for all system. Can you outline the different systems that are in place around the world?
In Europe, or not only Europe, in the developed countries, you find that wherever labor is strong, you find a national health service. Then you might have a national health insurance, and then in the United States, where labor is very weak, you do not have a national health insurance. So where a country have benefit coverage or not, depends very much on who is stronger, capital or labor, the employers or the labor unions and the labor parties. The United States would not have a labor party. And that labor has traditionally supported the Democratic Party, but the Democratic Party is not a labor party. And in that sense, when you have a strong left-wing party, let's say Labor Party, Social Democratic Party, let's go to Northern European countries. The left is very strong there. Unions, 80% of the labor force is unionized, and the Social Democratic Party has been in power for the majority of the number of years since World War II. You have a national health service. What does it mean? That, well, it's paid with taxes. And in that respect, and the administration is run by government, not necessarily by the central government. It can be run even by the municipalities or by the regional government. When labor is very weak and the employer is very strong, United States, where you do not have any form of national health program. We have Medicare that covers of the elderly, but covers less than 50% of the bills for taking care of the elderly. That is why a national health service is like in Great Britain, like Northern Europe, like Spain, like Italy, in which you have universal entitlement. But at the same time, besides that, and universal entitlement will require public funding, you also have the public administration responsible for the management of the system. You also have a national health insurance like they have in France, in Germany. They tend to have been governed by Christian Democratic parties, in which the employees, rather than paying to private insurance, pay to Social Security Trust Funds, and then the Social Security Trust Funds contract either with public or private institutions for the delivery of services. United States is an exception, where the employees pay to private insurance, who are making a lot of money. The best paid person in United States is Mr. Fried, who is the general manager of one of the insurance companies and makes $120 million a year, which is outrageous. That is paid with premium money. In the United States, we have no less than 100,000 people who die because of lack of care.
Not a week goes by that we don't see more attacks on health care of workers, health care of everybody in this country. It seems to be accelerating that things are getting much worse at a faster pace. Are things getting worse faster?
Sure. Every year, 1 million of our people lose their health benefit coverages. Things are getting worse and worse. Infant mortality, the first time since 1950s, has increased in the United States. In that respect, situations are getting worse, not only in terms of health benefit coverage, but also in terms of the health conditions. In that sense, the fact that between 16 and 17% of our people do not have any health benefit coverage whatsoever, that is not a country. I wonder where we can be called a civilized nation when we allow that to occur. And a basic human right is access to health care in times of need. We don't have that basic human right in the United States. It has been getting worse since the 80s, when the policies of weakening labor, it's a clear relationship between weakening labor on the one side and losing health benefit coverage on the other.
Doctor, I was struck by one of your analogies where you reference the movie John Q, where Denzel
right.
Washington is bereft with anger at the
right.
fact that his son is facing a life-threatening illness and the family's health insurance doesn't cover
right.
it. That takes me into the issue of race as a category. Now, clearly class plays a role. Parse out for us your thoughts on where this situation is allowed to exist, also because still the most impoverished and bottom rung of the class ladder are people of color.
Let me stress here a point which follows up from the previous one. The problem of the United States is not only that 44 million Americans do not have any form of coverage. The most important problem besides that is the undercoverage. So many people who have health benefit coverage are not aware of how limited their coverage is until they have to face it, like in the movie John Q. You remember, a snout worker, which they tend to have strong unions, and that they are the sector of the labor force that have a better health benefit coverage, who assumes that everything is taken care of, and suddenly when he needs that for his son, realizes that he does not have that coverage. That is extremely common. People do not realize, until they face the situation, that they are not covered. So the problem is not only non-coverage, but under-coverage. That is extremely common problem, and people are not even aware of that. Now, in terms of race, racism that condemns some sectors of the population to be in the lower echelon. I did a study, it was published in The Lancet, the most prestigious medical journal in Europe. I analyzed class mortality differentials versus race mortality differentials. Class mortality differentials are much, much higher than the race mortality differentials. But what is important is that when you look in terms of the so-called mortality differentials, you find out that they're basically class differential. That if blacks have higher mortality than whites, it's not because they are blacks in sense of something they are vulnerable for genes or whatever. It's because racism means the black and the unskilled working class sector of the population. They have higher mortality because they are unskilled working class. That discrimination against blacks puts them in the lower echelon of the working class. Let's assume that there will not be racism in the United States. Still, there will be class mortality differentials. The only thing is that rather than being black, it would be white or brown or yellow or whatever. But the thing that racism explains is that those at the bottom are black. But eliminating racism doesn't mean that the bottom will disappear. Color of that bottom, which is an important issue, I'm not minimizing that. But what is happening is racism leads put that sector of the population at the bottom. But what we had to fight is not only that blacks go to the bottom, but the bottom disappears. In the United States, a member of the corporate class lives 15 years more than a member of an unskilled worker.
And lastly, I guess the question is, what is to be done? Representative Conyers has a bill in Congress, a single-payer bill, which is picking up support. What's your prescription for change?
Labor has to play a very important role, and labor has not yet come up in favor of single payer. I think that in that respect is terribly important. Single payer is what the Canadians do. Single payer, as you know, is where the employees pay to the trust fund, which is in that sense funded by government. And then the public sector has a bargaining power to deal with the providers, eliminating all the insurance. The roots of the problem in the United States is that we spend far more than we need. We could provide full coverage to every citizen in the United States with less money, actually. But 25% of the money goes to the healthcare sector is just paper shuffling, administration, and then supporting these huge salaries of Mr. Fried, $150 million a year, which is outrageous. What the Canadians did was, well, let's eliminate all the insurance, and let's not do it in terms of the employers. People will pay a premium, employers will pay part of that, and will go to the public fund, and then the public fund will contract with the private sector. It will be something like Medicare, which the government will control it. By the way, Medicare, in terms of the administrative cost, is much, much lower than not in any other private-based insurance. Either expanding Medicare or whatever form, but that is a political situation. So it's not that issue, oh, we cannot pay because we don't have money for it. That is frivolous a statement. We do have money, but it has to go through different channels. That is the issue. But that is a political question. Labor has to come up in support of single payer. And then people had to mobilize and raise trouble. I think that we have reached a crisis in the United States of an enormous proportion. It's an epidemic proportion. The problems that people have, the major cause of bankruptcy for American families is they cannot pay American medical bills. So that is a major proportion, and I think it's equivalent to what happened in the 60s with the Civil Rights Movement. The United States has to have a healthcare rights movement where they had to go to the streets, people are willing to break the law, go to jail, whatever, but that needs to be stopped. It's completely unacceptable that in the United States, 44 million people go to bed every night without any form of health benefit coverage. This is unacceptable. We cannot be called a civilized nation and that happening. So people need to, and the establishment is extremely reactionary. So people need to go to the streets, and that even if it's needed, civil disobedience, because what is happening in the United States is just plain outrage.
That's quite a note to end on, and then we thank you very much, Dr. Vincente Naraparo, for joining us. Thank you.
Well, we're going to take a look at the 12 miners that died in the Sago mining disaster and the quote-unquote public hearings that are being held and what it portends for certainly safety on the job in one of the most dangerous professions. And Tony Oppegard is the former general counsel for the Kentucky Department of Mine Safety and Licensing. And we welcome Tony. I started by saying public hearing. Why don't we begin there? Indeed, is there a real public hearing? What's the nature of the hearing as it's been unfolding?
The so-called public hearing started yesterday and lasted about 10 hours. It was not a public hearing in the traditional sense or in the sense envisioned by Congress, which under the Mine Act, Congress envisioned a public hearing to be the accident investigation where all witnesses were subpoenaed. And in fact, in the Sago investigation, the Mine Safety and Health Administration, as well as the State Mine Safety Agency in West Virginia, have already conducted over 70 interviews behind closed doors. And this is a two-day sort of supplemental hearing to give the families an opportunity to make statements about their loved ones and also to ask questions. But it's not a true public hearing in the sense envisioned by Congress when it passed the Mine Safety Act.
There's no subpoena power. So what are we to really believe the purpose of this hearing is and its expectation for certainly the families that it will reveal some of the causes of the explosion and disaster in the Sago mine?
Abbott McAteer, who is Governor Manchin, the governor of West Virginia, his representative and advisor on the Sago disaster, is a longtime mine safety advocate and has really devoted his life to making working conditions better for miners, and was head of MSHA for 7 years in the Clinton administration. So I don't think Davitt's motivations really are in question, and I think he insisted on a public hearing when he was offered this job by Governor Manchin. However, I don't think that the public hearing is quite of the nature that Davitt envisioned when he accepted that job. I think he has insisted on a role for the families, and I think it's probably been a good thing for the families to be able to ask questions directly. I mean, they're not trained lawyers, and they perhaps are not asking some of the follow-up questions that an attorney would ask, but it gives them an opportunity to confront company officials and ask probing questions. I don't think that we learned a whole lot yesterday that wasn't known by reading the transcripts of the 70-some witnesses that have already been interviewed. And I must say that I think family members, as well as mine safety advocates, are upset by the manner in which MSHA has conducted the interviews, because the families have not been allowed to participate in those. They've been closed-door interviews. And the reality is that at least the company witnesses who have been interviewed, those are the management officials, they have had a company lawyer present. So the company really, from the beginning, has known what was being said behind closed doors, whereas the families did not until they received the transcripts just about 2 weeks ago.
I know one of the issues that came up, and you will certainly educate us to the significance of these, are issues about the seals on the mine and such other issues as pre-shift exams and whether they were done. So do explain more about those and their significance.
A seal, Mimi, is just when you have a part of a mine that you're abandoning for whatever reason. In this case, the Sago mine was having a lot of roof falls, which obviously are, you know, a major hazard to coal miners. And the roof was unstable. They were having a lot of water seeping into that area of the mine, which create electrical problems and other type of problems for the mine. And I believe it was around October of last year they decided to abandon that area of the mine and seal it off. And when you seal a portion of the mine, that area no longer needs to be ventilated. That is, you don't need to pump fresh air into the area. So you typically would take concrete blocks and build a wall, and, you know, you mortar those blocks and then you plaster them. And it's not going to be completely airtight, but substantially airtight to where dangerous gases in the sealed-off area will not migrate into the working part of the mine. Now, you know, when you build a seal, that in the sealed-off area, there is going to be an accumulation of methane, which is an odorless, tasteless gas that's explosive when it comprises 5 to 15% of the mine atmosphere. And it comes naturally from the coal seam. And you are going to have a buildup of methane, and you're also going to have the oxygen in the atmosphere is going to dissipate. So what you hopefully have is an inert atmosphere where you cannot have an explosion. You don't want oxygen in the sealed off area, and you know you're going to have methane. But nonetheless, under certain circumstances, you can have an explosion in the sealed off area. And that's one of the main questions in this case, is whether the seals were properly constructed. Neither the state or federal mining officials watched as those seals were being built. And in the transcripts, there are some questions from inexperienced miners who built the seals, whether they were following the proper procedures. And if they weren't, there's questions about whether or not methane could have leaked from the sealed area into the active area of the mine. And conversely, whether oxygen could have leaked from the active portion of the mine into the sealed off area, which would tend to permit an explosion if you had an ignition source.
And the witness that testified about this issue yesterday?
They did not have, and this is demonstrates one of the problems, I think, in this type of quote-unquote public hearing. They did not have the workers who built the seals available yesterday. The family members were asking questions of top management officials who would reference the transcripts and say, well, such and such a worker said such and such, and that really didn't hold much value. I mean, you can read the transcripts and see what the workers testified to a month or two earlier. So that's an example, I think, of why this is not a true public hearing and was really not the best way to conduct this investigation.
And the issue of the pre-shift exams, now there was a question of stolen notebooks and notes?
Right, and the families are obviously very concerned about this. Under the federal law, every mine has to be pre-shifted within 3 hours before the start of the shift. And the purpose of that, and what that means, is that an examiner that's called a fire boss has to go underground and examine every part of the mine in which miners may be working or traveling. And you're examining the mine for hazardous conditions. The mine environment can change very quickly. You can have buildups of methane, for instance, that would come about in a relatively short time. And that fire boss has to make gas checks, has to look for other dangerous conditions. And then he typically will either walk outside or travel outside and mark in the pre-shift book any hazardous conditions that were found, or he will call that information outside and someone else will write it down in the book and then he has to sign it. And those conditions have to be corrected before any miner is allowed to work in that area of the mine. So they're a critical part of any safety program for a coal mine. In this particular instance, Mr. Jameson, who was supposedly doing the pre-shift exam that morning for the two left section crew, and those are the miners who died in the explosion, testified that he wrote some notes in a little notepad that he kept in his shirt pocket, and that when he was done with his pre-shift exam, he traveled outside to transfer that information into the pre-shift exam book, and he said that he had taken off his clothes and left them on a bench by his locker, and that someone stole his clothes or removed his clothes. He never got them back. He never got back his pre-shift notes. And I think some of the families had concerns about the credibility of his testimony and thought it was rather suspicious. Why would someone steal a miner's shirt, you know? And I think the obvious implication is they're wondering if there was something in the notes that, you know, a person didn't want the families to learn about. So that's something we'll probably never know.
Hmm. After the explosion, I understand that company officials without breathing apparatuses actually went into the mine up to Block 58 to establish a fresh air base. Now, there's a whole issue with that, and that came out, and that's significant. Do tell us about that as well.
They knew that something was wrong, and they weren't quite sure what it was. So one crew got out of the mine. They felt a rush of air, and they saw dust floating in the atmosphere, and they knew something had happened. It could have been a major roof fall. It could have been an explosion. And they left the mine. three company officials then entered the mine to investigate, and they found some permanent ventilation stoppings, which helped direct the airflow, had been knocked out. So they knew they had a problem, and they went on to what was called Box 58, and this is without wearing any type of breathing devices. They were not under apparatus. And when they reached Block 58, they encountered bad air, that's carbon monoxide, and their gas detectors started beeping, and they knew they were in bad air, so they turned around at that point and went back outside. It turns out they were about 2,000 feet at that point from where the bodies of the miners were later found, 41 hours later. And there's some question as to when the mine rescue teams later entered the mine, whether they should have been allowed to go directly to Block 58 and set up what's called a fresh air base there, and in other words, start their mine rescue activities from several thousand feet underground at that point, rather than what they did, which was to start them from the very entrance of the mine and go painstakingly slow and making sure that everything is all right. Well, by the time they got to Block 58, many, many hours had elapsed. So one of the major issues that's going to be examined and one of the major questions the families have is why were the mine rescue teams not allowed to go directly to Block 58 since workers without apparatuses had already been there and suffered no ill effects. What the government is going to say basically is that you have to assure the safety of the mine rescue teams because there was a well-known explosion in eastern Kentucky in 1976 where miners died in an explosion, and then 2 days later, as rescue teams or recovery teams were going underground, there was a second explosion and there was a bunch more men killed, a total of 26 in all in the twin explosions.
In the remaining moment that we have, what do you expect or hope that can come out of these hearings? I mean, there clearly are issues of nationwide testing of emergency oxygen. What can we expect?
Some closure from the families. And I think the other point to be made is, you know, we've had 26 coal miners die in the country already this year, whereas we had 22 last year, and we're only a third of the way through the year. And I think the Bush administration has to receive a lot of the blame for that because of the really the anti-miner policies that they've used in terms of enforcement of the act.
Well, Tony Opegard, former general counsel for the Kentucky Department of Mine Safety and Licensing, thank you for giving us some update and some sense of what's been happening as the families do testify at the hearing being held on the tragedy at the Saco Mine. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
And this has been Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.